to see who's the bigger dog in the fight.
She shook her head.
Boys never really grow up, don't care how much cash they have. Did you know Ms. Kramer very well?
Asked Jameson. Sims said,
I guess as well as anyone in the building. She worked as a teacher out at the Brothers School. So we heard. What can you tell us about her? She was quiet, kept to herself. I mean, she was an attractive young woman, but she never had anyone over to her place, least that I know of. Why'd she move here from Dawson Towers? Is it cheaper here? Oh, yes, much cheaper. The Towers is far nicer, like I said, but our rooms are clean and we include trash service and cable TV. Did you ever see her go out at night? No, I get up very early and go to bed the same. If it was after 9 o'clock, I wouldn't see her leaving.
Jameson said,
Did she ever talk about her personal history, how she came to be here?
Sims sat back and thought about this for a few moments.
Come to think, not really. For some reason, I had the feeling that she was from the West Coast, but that's just a guess.
Decker looked out the window, where the rain was continuing to pour down. Did she say why she had come to London in the first place? Did she have a job lined up?
Not that she ever said, no. But she did work at the Brothers as the teacher, like I said, so maybe that's what brought her up here.
Jameson added,
Or was she coming here to be with someone, maybe followed a boyfriend? Not that I know of.
When was the last time you saw her? Asked Kelly. Sims looked pensive once more.
I believe it was a week ago today.
Decker glanced at Kelly. That tightens the coroner's outside TOD from 10 days to 5, since her body was found 2 days ago.
But weren't you concerned that you hadn't seen her for a week?
Asked Jameson.
No, because she said she was going on a little vacation.
Vacation where?
Asked Jameson, shooting a glance at Kelly, who looked equally surprised by this revelation.
She didn't tell me.
She didn't say if she was meeting someone or traveling with them, interjected Kelly.
No, again, we didn't really discuss it.
Did she have any friends who lived here?
Asked Jameson.
Not that she mentioned to me.
Not to sound like a cliche, Ida, said Kelly. But have you seen any strangers lurking around? Or did Irene mention she was having a problem with anyone?
No, nothing like that,
replied Sims, looking alarmed.
This is a good town, safe for the most part. Oh, I know some of those bozos lose their tempers and get in fights and somebody ends up dead, but, well, people don't go around murdering each other on purpose.
Until now, said Decker. I think it's time we went over her room. The apartment was neat, perhaps too much so, thought Decker. The furnishings looked like they had come with the apartment, a fact that Sims had confirmed for them. The tiny kitchen was utilitarian and appeared as though it had never been used. The bedroom held a bed and not much else. There were no books, photos, or mementos. No desktop or laptop computer, and no power cords showing she had such devices. Decker eyed Kelly. Sims said she never saw Kramer go out at night, presumably because she went to bed too early.
She would have hit the streets long after Sims was in bed.
Sims also said that she wasn't aware of Kramer's having any friends in the building, but she could be wrong about that too,
remarked Jameson.
Kelly said, But would she bring her clients back here or sleep with someone in her own building? The jig would be up.
Decker shook his head. But what if she just had someone over for consensual sex?
Kelly looked intrigued. Maybe she had a boyfriend that Sims didn't know about.
She ever mention anyone like that to you?
Asked Jameson.
He shook his head. But it's not like she would have.
Decker said, Has this place been dusted for prints?
No, because it wasn't the crime scene.
It needs to be done, said Decker sharply.
We've got one tech, and he rides the circuit for a few other police forces around the area. I'll get him to make this a priority for us.
Decker said, What about her car? I didn't see a Honda parked on the street.
We've got a bolo out on it, but nothing yet.
If she was working through a website, she probably had a laptop, and she had to have a phone,
said Jameson.
I'm sure she did, but we haven't found either one, replied Kelly.
Where would she typically meet up with the men? You mentioned you met her at a flop house?
Yeah, we can go there next.
Decker said, and we'll need to talk to the brothers, obviously.
I don't believe they could have had anything to do with this. They're a pacifist group.
Pacifists or not, it only takes one bad apple in the bunch. And there's almost always one bad apple in every bunch.
Chapter 10.
I take it this is the really, really seedy side of town,
said Jameson as they pulled up in front of a dilapidated, wooden-clad, three-story building that looked around a century old. It was about a quarter of a mile from Kramer's apartment, but in an even less desirable part of London.
You could say that.
Who owns the building? Asked Decker.
Hugh Dawson, or one of his companies. In fact, like Ida Sims mentioned, he owns pretty much all of London, the good and bad parts.
The man at the front desk was about 40 and looked like he would rather be anywhere else on Earth than where he currently was. He put down his iPhone, took off his black-rimmed specs, wiped them on the sleeve of his shirt, and replaced them as they strode up to him. He barely glanced at Decker or Jameson.
Hi, Joe, said the man, nodding at Kelly with a wary look.
Ernie, these folks are with the FBI out of Washington, replied Kelly, indicating Decker and Jameson.
Ernie's prominent Adam's apple bobbed up and down like an out-of-whack elevator car.
Okay, he said suspiciously. Never met any FBI agents before. You look pretty normal. Thought you'd be scarier.
We can be very scary, if the situation calls for it,
said Jameson brightly.
We want to ask you some questions and have a look around, said Kelly. I'm sure you have no problem with that, right?
Yeah, I do. What kind of questions? And I don't know if you can look around without a warrant.
Kelly leaned in close to Ernie.
You surprise me, Ernie. That doesn't sound too helpful or friendly.
I'm not paid to be either one.
Fact is, we're investigating a murder.
Who got killed?
You would probably know her as Mindy.
Ernie's features screwed up tight.
Mindy? I don't know nobody by that name. Would have remembered that one.
Sure you do, Ernie, said Kelly. I met her here one night. You saw me with her, and I saw you.
Ernie shook his head.
Your memory must be a lot better than mine.
Kelly glanced past him.
What do we have here? An ex-con drug dealer with a bottle of pills on that shelf back there that doesn't look like prescription drugs. That would be a serious violation of your parole. You don't want to go back inside, do you?
Ernie glanced nervously at the bottle.
Those ain't mine. Just holding them for a buddy.
Then you have no objection to me seeing what they are.
Kelly started to walk behind the reception desk to get the bottle.
Okay, I know Mindy, he blurted out. Are we done here?
When was the last time you saw her?
I forget.
Kelly started to reach for the pill bottle.
Okay, it was last week. Be more precise than that, said Decker.
Ernie rubbed his lower lip and did the calculation in his head.
6 days ago.
Decker looked at Kelly.
Now our TOD is down to 4 days. That alone made it worth talking to this guy.
Did you speak with her? Asked Kelly.
No.
Was she with anyone?
Interjected Jameson.
She doesn't come here unless she's with someone, replied Ernie flatly. That's sort of the point of the, line of work she was in.
The guy's name? Asked Kelly.
They don't tell me. They pay me cash and they get the room. And I don't ask no questions and nobody shows ID. Description, then?
Demanded Decker.
Short, muscular, blonde, young, stupid, horny.
Male or female?
Asked Jameson.
Are you serious? Ernie snapped. It was a guy.
Fracker? Asked Kelly.
He looked it. Hands all chewed up and skin sunburnt and a wallet full of cash nearly as big as he was. How long were they here? Asked Decker. About 45 minutes. They usually all take about that much time. I don't imagine there's much chit-chat that goes on. Did they leave together or separate?
Asked Decker.
Guy left first, then Mindy. How'd the guy seem? How do you think? He was smiling ear to ear with a spring in his step. Hell, it was like he'd won the lottery or something.
She seem okay? Asked Kelly.
She didn't seem not okay.
Be more specific,
prompted Jameson.
Well, she seemed happy, actually. Maybe the sex was good. I don't know.
Jameson said,
you must have other women come in here with men to have a good time.
Look, I don't know what you mean, blustered Ernie.
We're not looking to bust you over this,
said Jameson.
I just want to know, was Mindy different from the other ladies?
Decker glanced at her and then stared at Ernie, awaiting his answer.
Different how?
I think you know how,
said Jameson. Ernie let out a long breath.
Look, the other gals come down still counting their money if they do take cash. Some insist on Venmo because it's safer, but it's all business with them. It's not like they enjoy getting strangers off over and over.
Very perceptive of you. And Mindy?
Well, she didn't seem that way. Never saw her with any money, in fact. And she wasn't like the other gals. Over half of them are strung out all the time. To my eye, I doubt the lady ever popped a pill or even smoked a joint.
Well, you're the expert on that, Ernie, noted Kelly.
Would you recognize this guy again if you saw him?
Asked Jameson.
Doubtful. They all look the same to me, and I see enough of them.
Kelly eyed the stairs.
Take us to the room they were using.
Okay, but there have been other people in there since then.
Ernie grabbed a key from a box on the front desk and led them up a flight of steps to the top floor and then down the hall. He unlocked the door and motioned them in.
Have at it.
He left them there and scurried back down the stairs like a rat abandoning a ship. Decker wasn't even sure the man would still be there when they came back down.
Chapter 11.
This is beyond disgusting,
observed Jameson.
Do they even clean these rooms?
The carpet was tattered and stained. The small bed was unmade. The smell in the air was foggy and foul. The paint on the walls was chipped and peeling. The few bits of other furniture looked decades old and badly in need of repair. There was a single bare light bulb clinging to the ceiling like a barnacle on a ship's hull. Jameson's gaze dropped to the floor, where sat an opened plastic condom package.
Okay, I'm getting a tetanus booster as soon as we get out of here.
Decker was walking around the room taking everything in. His observations were being placed on mental slides and uploaded to the cloud that constituted his largely infallible memory.
We'll at least need to check all the prints here and try to do an elimination run.
Kelly said,
well, from what Ernie told us, it seemed like Kramer and the young buck had sex that night.
Yeah, it does,
said Jameson.
And maybe the guy was so happy because she didn't charge him for it.
And Ernie said Kramer was happy, too. I wonder why.
Decker said,
we have to retrace her steps, every minute of every day. Now Sims told us that Kramer was planning to go on a trip.
He eyed Kelly.
It's early September, so I assume school has just started, unless the brothers have a different schedule.
No, they pretty much follow a traditional schedule when it comes to that.
Is she the only teacher there?
Except for the woman who lives out there and is a member of the brothers' colony. Kramer taught the subjects the state requires under the compulsory education, English, social studies, math, that sort of thing.
So what were they going to do while she was gone?
Asked Jameson.
Probably just have the kids taught by the other teacher. The brothers only go to school until they're 15. A week isn't going to matter much one way or another.
Decker said,
let's go talk to the brothers then.
We'll have to make an appointment.
Decker frowned.
Why? Are they that busy?
It's just common courtesy.
Fine. Then call them and tell them we're on our way.
Decker, they might not like us barging in like that.
Decker stared down at Kelly.
I doubt Irene Kramer liked being butchered, so I'll take finding her killer as fast as possible over somebody else's possible hurt feelings over a visit.
He eyed the local cop severely.
This is a murder investigation, Kelly. Nothing takes precedence over that, at least in my book. If you think differently, we might have a problem working together.
Kelly shot Jameson a glance and then looked back at Decker.
I have no problem with that.
Glad to hear it. Let's go.
What the hell is that thing?
Asked Jameson. They were in the rental SUV heading east. They had cleared a slight rise in the otherwise flat plains and spied what appeared to be an Egyptian pyramid with its top chopped off and what looked like an enormous golf ball set atop this flat space. It was about 150 feet high and made of what looked to be stone. It dwarfed the other buildings set behind it, all enclosed by double perimeter fencing with razor wire toppers.
That's the Douglas S. George Defense Complex, otherwise known as London Air Force Station, replied Kelly, who was riding next to Jameson. She said,
Air Force Station? I don't see any planes or runways.
It's not an airbase. It's an air station, although they do have a runway for planes and a helipad, and a super-duper radar array is housed in that blob. It can see into space. It's part of the early warning system in case somebody fires nukes at North America.
Stuck way out here?
Commented Jameson.
I guess some politician from North Dakota lobbied hard for it, but it's pretty ugly, so would you want something like that in your backyard? Anyway, it's been here since the 50s, long before I was alive.
He pointed to an upcoming road.
Hang a right there, Alex.
She did so, and they found themselves passing fairly close to the Air Force Station.
Not too far now, said Kelly. Just up ahead, we turn left, and then we're there.
Decker looked puzzled. But it looks like we're still on the Air Force property.
Kelly smiled.
About 10 years ago, most of the property went up for auction, and the brothers bought it. And then Frackers recently leased some of it from them.
The brothers bought land from the federal government that has an Air Force installation on it?
Said Jameson, looking surprised.
I guess Uncle Sam is trying to cut costs, or they didn't need all of the acreage. And they didn't buy the Air Force station, of course, just the spare acreage. Now, the brothers did need that land. They've spun off a few new colonies, and they needed the space for those folks to set up their farms and other operations.
Just so I've got this straight, you have a religious sect plowing fields right next to a government eye in the sky looking for nukes coming our way?
It would make for a great skit on Saturday Night Live, observed Kelly.
Jameson hung the next left, and another quarter mile down a freshly paved road, they arrived at the brothers' compound. Kelly had phoned ahead, and there were two men waiting by a large metal farm gate. Even in the heat and humidity, they were both dressed in heavy dark clothing and wore battered black fedoras with silk gray bands. Full beards covered their jaws and chins. One wore a pair of old-fashioned pince-nez glasses. The other one, younger by about 10 years than his late 50-ish companion, gazed at them curiously through horn-rimmed spectacles. About 100 feet behind them was a tall woman in her late 40s with brown hair flecked with silver, wearing a long dress with colorful stripes and a kerchief with white polka dots. She, too, was watching them closely. In the distance, Decker could see low-slung cinder-block buildings fronted either by well-tended lawns or crushed gravel. There were large corrugated metal buildings, some grain silos, fenced crop fields, and many pieces of neatly arranged heavy farming equipment, along with some other machinery that, to Decker's eye, looked like they would be used in a building or manufacturing process. Everything was laid out with thought and precision, he concluded.
Like I said before, it's all communal living here, said Kelly as the SUV came to a stop. No personal property, really, except your clothes and what's in your house.
The big buildings?
Asked Jameson.
They sell eggs and vegetables and other things that they grow. They also make furniture and some parts for manufacturing, and they also do metal fabrication. The fracking people buy from them. They have their own truck fleet to deliver everything. It's a fairly large-scale operation when all is said and done. They're very self-sufficient. Their English is excellent, though their first language is German.
And you haven't told them why we're here?
Said Jameson.
Kelly's look darkened. No, not over the phone. It's going to come as a shock.
I'm surprised they have phones, she said.
Well, they don't allow TV or the internet, strictly speaking,
but younger members do use Facebook and Instagram and email to keep in touch with friends, though that's closely regulated. And cell phones are necessary for business and personal tasks, so they have those too. There's only one central hardline phone. They worry that the outside world will try to encroach on them.
And maybe convince some of the younger members to leave?
Said Jameson. The outside world can be enticing, for all the wrong reasons, conceded Kelly. They climbed out of the vehicle and approached the two men, who came forward and extended their hands in greeting. They all introduced themselves to one another. The older man was Peter Gunther, who was the minister of this particular colony, and his companion was Milton Ames, the secretary. The woman, who had remained standing back, was Ames's wife, Susan, her husband told them. She was the tailor of the colony, Gunther said.
And what does that mean?
Asked Jameson curiously. She picks all the clothes, or at least the fabric, and is in charge of the making of the clothes, offered Ames. Jameson turned and waved at the woman, but she simply stared back and didn't return the gesture. Gunther warily looked at Decker.
So, the FBI? Joe didn't say why you wanted to meet with us.
Kelly said, Can we go inside? We're going to tell you why we're here, but it's not going to be pleasant. Gunther and Ames exchanged a startled glance. Gunther turned and led them toward one of the buildings. It was a startlingly clean communal kitchen with two long picnic-style tables down each wall and a similar table in the middle of the room. The appliances were commercial grade. A woman in a dress similar to Susan Ames's was unpacking some supplies and placing them neatly in overhead cabinets.
Excuse us, Martha, said Gunther. We need to talk to these folks about some important matters.
Martha glanced suspiciously at Decker and Jameson and hurried into another room. They sat down at the table in the middle of the space. Gunther clasped his hands in front of him.
Now, why are you here? Gunther asked Kelly.
Irene Kramer. Gunther kept his surprised gaze on Kelly.
Irene, what about her?
Decker interjected.
We understand that she was going on a trip.
Ames spoke up.
That's right. Our school had just started back up, but we saw no reason not to let her go. She coordinated with Doris, the colony teacher. It was only a week or so. She should be back soon.
When did she tell you about the trip?
Asked Jameson.
Gunther said, Why all the questions about Irene?
Kelly glanced at Decker, who nodded.
Irene was found dead, Kelly said to Gunther.
Dead! Exclaimed a horrified Gunther. Where? How?
The where was out in the middle of nowhere. She was found by a hunter. The how was that she was murdered.
Well, I'm not surprised.
They all turned to see Susan Ames standing in the doorway where Martha had earlier walked through.
Susan? Exclaimed Ames. What in heaven's name do you mean you're not surprised?
Mindy? It was only a matter of time.
Chapter 12.
Okay, I admit that one hit me out of left field, said Kelly.
They were outside in the heat and he was smoking a cigarette. Decker stood there looking back at the building they'd left a few minutes ago. Jameson was standing a little away from Kelly's cigarette smoke. Gunther and Milton Ames had apparently been so taken aback by Susan Ames's statement that they had quickly ushered Decker and company out of the building while they discussed things among themselves.
She knew about Kramer's other life, noted Decker, which begs the question of why she continued to allow her to teach their kids. And there's something else.
What? Kelly asked as he tossed his spent smoke on the gravel.
If Susan Ames knew, who else did here?
You really think one of the brothers butchered Kramer like that?
Locals can come here. Kramer worked here, and she was an outsider. Any other non-brothers around?
Kelly looked shrewdly at him.
Yeah, they hire contractors to help with the manufacturing stuff and some of the farming operations.
Okay.
Decker glanced toward the dining hall.
If they keep us out here much longer, I'm just going to kick the door down before a heat stroke fully sets in.
They might not like that, warned Kelly.
They're pacifists,
So what are they going to do about it?
Kelly grinned and then pointed. Well, you just got your wish.
Decker looked over to see Peter Gunther standing at the open door and waving for them to rejoin him. Inside, Susan and Milton Ames were sitting side by side at the center table. He appeared upset, and she looked somewhat contrite. Milton said,
Susan wants to explain her earlier remark.
Okay, said Kelly, sitting down opposite them while Decker and Jameson hovered behind.
Kelly said to Susan,
So you knew about Irene?
Susan wouldn't look up.
Yes, and it was very cruel what I said before. I don't know what I was thinking. I suppose I was upset.
Now she did look up, and her eyes were watery.
But I did fear for her, and it seems that those fears were unfortunately justified.
How did you know about her other life? Asked Decker.
This past spring, our oldest son had gone to visit my sister and her family in Pennsylvania. They're not part of us, but we do visit and keep in touch. He traveled by bus. I went into town to pick him up at the depot. He was late coming in. It must have been after midnight. I was waiting in my truck when I saw her walking down the street with some man.
Irene, you mean? Said Kelly.
I had to look three times before I recognized her. It was more the way she walked, really, and how she would tilt her head. I would see her do that at the school all the time.
Then you're a careful observer, noted Decker.
Susan glanced nervously at her husband, who still stared down at the table.
I am someone who notices things. My duties here require that attention to detail.
Go on, prompted Kelly.
Well, the man was obviously drunk and had his hands all over her. I thought she might be in trouble, so I got out of the truck and called out to her. She was horrified to see me, I could tell. She started trying to get rid of the man who was with her, but he said the name Mindy, which is how I knew about that. Anyway, the man yelled that he'd pay her an extra $100 if she performed a certain act on him.
Susan blushed deeply as she said this, and Milton and Gunther looked like they might be ill. She noticed this and hurried on.
That's when I realized it was more than some date that got out of hand. The man finally left, and we sat in my truck and talked. She could tell I was very shocked, and she explained at length about what was going on. Take your time and tell us everything you can remember,
said Jameson.
She said her mother had cancer, had no insurance, and she was sending all the money she made by being with men.
Here, Gunther made a clucking sound.
So as to help her mother,
finished Susan hurriedly. So, just to be clear, she told you she was selling sex for money? Said Kelly.
I know nothing about it, of course, but isn't that the point, to do it for money?
Kelly glanced at Decker and didn't answer.
Did you believe her about her mother? Asked Decker.
I was so stunned, I didn't know what to believe. But she seemed incredibly sincere, and so against my better judgment, I promised I wouldn't tell anyone about what I had seen. She would have been instantly dismissed from working here, if I had.
Of course she would have, bellowed Gunther. And you should have told us, Susan. To think that our children were being taught by someone who engaged in such immoral behavior.
Susan glanced up at him defiantly.
And would it be moral to let her mother die?
I'm sure there were other ways, said Gunther. Do you not agree, Milton?
Milton looked startled, as though he were a student hiding in the back of the room when the teacher called on him for an answer he didn't have.
Yes, of course. I'm sure there were other pathways.
He brightened.
She could have come to us. We would have helped her. Exactly, said Gunther.
Maybe she didn't want anyone's help,
said Susan dismissively.
Well, then she alone should be accountable for it, said Gunther firmly. It looks like she was, said Decker, drawing all their attention back to him. Someone took her life, very brutally.
He scrutinized Susan.
What else did she tell you? Was she afraid of anyone? Had she received threats of some kind? Was anyone stalking her?
Nothing like that.
She paused.
But there was something. Something she said. It was about 2 weeks ago. She was here working on lesson plans when I popped in. What did she say?
Interjected Jameson.
As detailed as you can be, please. She was looking upset. I asked her why. She told me she had gotten a note or letter that had disturbed her.
But you said she hadn't been threatened, noted Kelly.
Well, she didn't say that the note was threatening, just that it had disturbed her.
Did she say who it was from? Asked Decker.
No, but it was shortly thereafter that she mentioned taking a trip.
She eyed her husband.
You were there, too, when she asked for permission to miss a week of school.
Yes, that's right. She said she was going to visit her mother. And where did her mother live?
She never said,
replied Susan.
In fact, I know little about her background. But surely if she was teaching here, you needed to know about her background,
said Jameson.
She had to have appropriate credentials and experience and all that. Kelly said he learned from you that she had graduated from Amherst.
Milton chimed in.
Oh, yes. She brought her credentials and teaching certificate with her when she interviewed for the job.
Do you have copies of those documents? Asked Decker.
Milton said,
No, I looked at them, but didn't make copies.
Did you do a background check on her?
Asked Jameson. Milton shook his head.
No, we didn't do that. She didn't seem like a person who would have a criminal record. She was a young woman, nice, presentable, with a college degree from an excellent school.
He glanced at Gunther.
It didn't occur to us that there might be a problem in her past. She worked here for a year without any issues at all.
And she was a very good teacher,
added Susan.
She was lively and engaging, and her curriculum was interesting and never crossed the bounds of what we value here. And the children loved her. They're going to be devastated by this.
We'll find another teacher, said Gunther firmly.
I'm sure you will, said Decker. And let's hope nothing happens to that person.
This has absolutely nothing to do with us, said Gunther indignantly. This woman was a prostitute. I can only imagine the unsavory and dangerous people she would run into doing that sort of thing. I'm sure one of them is responsible for her death. I wish I was as sure as you are,
replied Decker before looking over at Susan.
When was the last time you saw Kramer?
She considered this question, her lips moving as though she were counting off days in her head.
8 days ago. Here, at the school?
Asked Jameson. Susan shook her head.
I was in town. We needed some supplies. There's a shop we use. They normally deliver out here, but they had two people out sick, so I drove into town.
So where did you see her?
Asked Decker.
She was coming out of a building.
Did you talk to her? Asked Kelly.
I asked her when she was leaving on her trip to see her mother. I thought she would have already left, actually. She said she had been delayed, but that she was leaving the next day and she would be back to teach when she had originally said she would.
Decker said,
Did she say how she was getting to wherever she was going?
She had a car, an old Honda. I know that because she drove it to our school, but she didn't tell me how she would be traveling to her mother's.
Jameson said,
How did she look? Nervous? Happy?
Susan thought about this for a moment.
Resigned. Yes, she seemed resigned.
Decker said,
As though her fate was already decided, you mean?
Well, I didn't think that at the time because I didn't know she was going to be murdered, but now that I know, I would say yes.
Kelly said,
So maybe she saw her own death coming.
Decker glanced at him.
Well, she saw right, didn't she?
Chapter 13.
Do you happen to know a guy named Stan Baker?
Decker asked Kelly on the drive back. Kelly said,
Stan Baker. Name doesn't ring a bell. Should I know him?
He works for a fracking company. He's my brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law? So you knew he was here then?
No, it was a surprise. He's a big guy, almost as big as me. Reddish hair, with the same color beard, rugged in appearance. Ring any bells now?
Kelly smiled. Hell, you just described half the guys here, Decker.
Yeah, I guess so, said Decker absently.
Jameson said,
We didn't find any note or letter at Kramer's apartment. She might have taken it with her, or she might have destroyed it.
At least it shows she was concerned about something, said Decker. And it might also account for the air of resignation Susan Ames alluded to.
What can you tell us about Caroline Dawson?
Asked Jameson suddenly as she glanced briefly at Decker.
Caroline? Said Kelly. Why? Did you meet her?
Just for a minute. She's apparently dating Decker's brother-in-law.
Kelly looked at her oddly.
Really? Okay. Well, she's Hugh Dawson's only child. Well, his only living child.
What do you mean?
Asked Jameson.
There was a brother, Hugh Jr. He was older than Caroline.
What happened to him?
He killed himself. This was a number of years ago.
My God, do you know why?
His father and him didn't see eye to eye on some things, and it just got out of hand. I guess depression set in, and that was that.
Care to elaborate? Asked Decker.
Not really, no. I don't like telling stories out of school, and it has nothing to do with the case.
And Dawson's wife?
She died a few years ago, in an accident.
Caroline mentioned being involved in her father's businesses,
said Jameson.
He nodded. Hugh's training her to take over one day. She's really smart, went to college out of state, and then came back here to begin her apprenticeship.
She seemed more of a party girl when we met her,
noted Jameson.
She works hard, and she's ambitious. She was a right little hellion in her teens, but she knows she has the golden egg in front of her, and she's not about to screw that up. Then again, Hugh's only 60 and in good health, far as I know. He won't be retiring anytime soon.
It sounds like you know her well, observed Decker.
Kelly looked thoughtful. We grew up together. We're pretty close all the way through high school. But I don't think anyone really knows Caroline. She can be fun on the outside, but most never get to see her inner core. At least that's my observation.
And her father?
Asked Jameson.
Hugh Dawson is a big, gregarious man who likes to come across as just a regular guy despite his wealth. He'll make you laugh, but if you cross him, he'll make you cry instead. Not a man you want to get on the wrong side of.
So what's the deal with this military complex?
Interjected Decker.
Who works there?
It used to be a mix of folks, military and contractors, but a year or so ago the military outsourced all the operations to a contractor. They have their own fire station, bowling alley, and even a bar. An Air Force colonel still commands the installation, Mark Sumter.
Ever had any problems over there?
Nothing serious.
You know this Sumter guy?
Yeah, he's been here about a year. But why all the questions about that place?
Woman gets butchered and there's a sensitive government facility nearby. It's at least worth a look.
He glanced at Jameson, who said,
And it might explain why the FBI got called in.
And Kramer came here about a year ago, too, same as this Colonel Sumter, added Decker.
Kelly nodded slowly.
Okay, yeah, I can see that. Maybe.
So maybe you can arrange an interview and visit, said Decker.
I'll make a call, sure.
They dropped Kelly off, and Decker and Jameson returned to their hotel. As they walked in, Decker's phone buzzed. He looked spooked as he stared at the screen.
Who is it?
Asked Jameson, noting his expression.
Bogart?
No, it's my sister Renee.
When Decker made no move to answer the call, Jameson said,
Well, you wanted to talk to her. Here's your chance.
Decker moved over to a corner of the room and put the phone to his ear.
Hey, Renee.
Stan called me, Amos.
Yeah, I figured. Look, he told me about you two.
We're getting divorced. We're not terminally ill, so don't sound so morbid. It's not the end of the world. And it's not like you kept in touch. You've never even visited me here.
Well, it's a long way.
And it was a long way every time I came to visit you, but I didn't call to argue.
Why did you call then?
I wanted to just let you know that despite Stan and I going our separate ways, we're doing okay. The kids understand. They're fine with it.
Why didn't you call and tell me?
I left 2 messages for you. And what would you have done? I figured that you'd find out at some point. Diane knows, of course. She's already been down to see me.
Stan said you tried to work it out.
And I imagine you think we didn't try hard enough. But we did, Amos. We just couldn't make it work. I'm not getting any younger, and I've got 2 kids still at home and 1 in college. And Danny just graduated from college, and he's moving back here. I didn't have time for endless counseling when it became clear it was going nowhere.
Are you going to be okay financially?
Stan makes good money, and he's helping with all of the kids' expenses. And we had college funds set up, and I've got a good job that pays well and has excellent health benefits.
So what happened? You both seem so happy.
How would you know? I haven't seen you since the funerals. And if you call more than once a year, well, you called the wrong number. I almost had a heart attack when you picked up just now.
I guess I have been sort of AWOL lately.
I invited you to live with us after Cassie and Molly died. When you turned that down, I offered to move the whole family to Ohio to be close to you.
I couldn't let you do that, Renee. That would have disrupted all of your lives.
I would have done it in a heartbeat. You are my only brother, after all.
I got through it. I'm okay.
I know you found the person who did it, though you never talked to me about it. I read it in the newspaper.
She added in a hurt tone.
Yeah, well, it's not something I really wanted to talk about.
But it must have offered you some closure.
Not as much as you might think.
She didn't say anything for a long moment.
So how was Stan?
He looked okay. When I saw him, he...
Decker could not bring himself to tell her.
It's okay, Amos. I know he's seeing someone. It's okay. We are divorcing.
Relieved, he said,
So are you seeing anyone?
Yeah, my 4 kids. Motherhood is sort of a full-time gig, but once I have some time getting to know myself again and actually taking care of some of my needs, I intend to find some companionship. Don't know if I'll ever take the plunge again. How about you?
How about me what?
Are you seeing anyone?
I keep pretty busy, too. Look, I gotta go. Something's come up.
Good talking to you, little brother,
said Renee sarcastically. Decker clicked off and rejoined Jameson.
How'd it go?
She asked anxiously. Decker started to say something, but then shut his mouth, turned, and walked off. Jameson watched him go and then said under her breath,
That good, huh?
Chapter 14. Decker and Jameson grabbed an early dinner at the hotel.
I checked the weather outside. It's down to 81 with 1,000% humidity. Winter is clearly upon us,
added Jameson, attempting a smile.
Decker put down his menu. It's like Mark Twain said, everybody complains about the weather, but no one ever does a damn thing about it.
After the waitress took their orders and departed, Jameson said,
So why don't you tell me how it went with your sister?
She gave him a look.
If you remember, you just walked off without a word.
Decker sighed.
She said she's doing fine financially. Her focus is on the kids, and she said they're handling it okay. When things slow down a bit, she's going to concentrate on her own well-being.
Well, that's smart. And Stan?
She said it was amicable, and that he's been very supportive.
I guess not all divorces are that easy, so good for them.
Decker said,
Did you ever consider getting married again?
If you can believe it, I never ran into Mr. Wright, which includes my ex-husband.
I'm sure you had suitors.
How very old-fashioned of you. I had men who were pursuing me, yes. What they were pursuing me for, well, I don't think it was marriage.
Decker held up a hand.
Okay, sorry I asked.
I speak my mind, I'm independent, and some guys find that a turnoff.
She paused.
Although I seem to have no problem playing second fiddle to you.
Decker looked surprised at her statement.
I wouldn't describe it that way. I rub people the wrong way. Sometimes that works, other times not. You're good at rebalancing things.
So we make a good team, you think?
He seemed startled by the query.
Yes, don't you?
She patted his hand.
Don't worry, I'm not looking to get a new partner. I'm just now breaking you in.
Can anybody join the party, or is it totally private?
They looked up to see Caroline Dawson standing next to their table. She was dressed far more conservatively than the last time they had seen her. A modest white blouse buttoned to her neck, black slacks, low pumps, and her hair pulled back. Her makeup was minimal, but her personality was as effervescent as the first time they had met. Jameson indicated a seat.
Help yourself. We're just grabbing a quick bite.
Dawson sat down.
Stan told me about you, Decker. Said you're a crackerjack detective, the FBI's finest.
Did he? Said Decker, not looking pleased.
And here I was asking you to go clubbing. I'm really sorry about that. You had no way of knowing why we were here?
Interjected Jameson. She glanced at Jameson.
He didn't really know you, but if you're an FBI agent, you must be great too. And I love it that they have women in the ranks doing the job and not just guys.
I agree with you there,
replied Jameson.
Well, it's nice that tiny London, North Dakota gets so much firepower. You should finish solving it in no time. Stan said it was a murder?
That's right.
Irene Kramer?
How'd you know that?
Hal Parker. He works for my father sometimes as a hunter. He was tracking down a wolf that was doing damage to some of my dad's livestock when he found the body.
You keep livestock out in this heat?
Said Jameson.
The winter is actually harder on them than the summer, and when it's 50 below out, we provide dry bedding, which is important. Their coats will adapt to the cold, but when they're penned inside, you have to keep an eye on the ventilation. Too much nitrogen, moisture, or odor in the air and other factors like that can lead to respiratory infections. With the heat, it's important to make sure they have water and shade and enough to eat. My dad's been doing this a long time, and he gets the balance just right.
And it sounds like he taught you well,
commented Jameson. Dawson brightened.
He has taught me well, sometimes too well, such that I'm sitting in a restaurant with two strangers talking about cow pens and nitrogen levels.
Jameson said,
the closest I've ever gotten to livestock is at a petting zoo.
What else did Hal Parker tell you about finding the body? Asked Decker.
That he threw up, that he'd never seen anything that awful in his life, and he fought in the Middle East.
But he couldn't have known it was Irene Kramer. She was identified after she was brought in.
Dawson sat back and looked at Decker in a new, perhaps sobering light.
I'm good friends with Liz Southern. She told me, but I don't want her to get into trouble. I was just curious after Hal told me he'd found a body of a woman.
That's okay,
said Jameson.
It's a small town, and news was bound to get around.
Got any suspects?
None that we can talk about, advised Decker quickly. Did you know Ms. Kramer?
No, but I knew that she taught school over at the Brothers Colony.
Do you know the folks there?
I can't say I really know them all that well.
She glanced at Decker.
So Stan also told me that you're his brother-in-law?
Soon to be ex-brother-in-law, as I'm sure he also told you.
I wouldn't be seeing him if he were still happily married,
she said firmly.
That's good to know, replied Decker. I have to admit that I went to the OK Corral Saloon and watched you two dancing. Frankly, I don't think I've ever seen him more uncomfortable.
Dawson smiled.
He is very awkward in his own skin when it comes to things like that, but it's also very endearing.
She glanced up at Decker.
But I found that I like showing him there's more to life, you know?
I can see that,
said Jameson appreciatively.
Sometimes guys need a little helping hand in that regard.
He's nice, and there's something about him, I don't know, this naive quality that really appeals to me. Plus, he's quite the gentleman, and he fought for his country. I mean, I definitely feel safe when I'm around him.
Did he talk about his combat days? Asked Decker.
Never, and I've asked.
Decker said,
He was Special Forces, fought in the Middle East, got a bunch of medals, was even wounded. But the ones who do the most in war don't talk about it. That's why Stan keeps quiet about it. He's a straight-up guy.
Wow, that's impressive.
I'm not sure he can keep up with you, though, said Decker.
We're not looking to get married. We're just having fun.
Dawson's smile faded as she looked over Jameson's shoulder. Jameson and Decker turned to see what she was staring at. A short man, barely 5'2", in his early 60s, had come into the dining room. Despite the heat, he was dressed in an expensive woolen three-piece suit and blue paisley tie with a matching pocket handkerchief. Decker thought he had never seen a pair of more intense eyes. Next to him was a good-looking, tall, well-built man about Caroline Dawson's age.
"Let me take a wild guess,"
said Jameson.
"Is that Stuart McClellan?"
Dawson said,
"Yes, and his son Shane. I wonder what they're doing here."
"Do they not frequent places like this?" asked Decker, studying the two men.
"They don't frequent any place owned by my father. At least Stuart doesn't."
"Well, from what we learned, that severely limits their options," said Decker.
"Something my father takes delight in."
Stuart McClellan spotted Dawson and headed over with his son in tow.
"Hello, Caroline," said McClellan, his voice surprisingly low and baritone. So much so that Decker wondered if it was affected.
"Stuart?"
She glanced at his son.
"Hi, Shane."
Shane broke into a grin and drew closer to the table.
"Hey, Caroline, what's up?"
His father aggressively elbowed him aside.
"And these two are the FBI agents?"
"Yes,"
said Jameson after glancing at Decker.
"Nasty business. I'm Stuart McClellan, by the way. You probably passed some of my fracking wells when you were coming in."
"We did,"
replied Jameson.
"And I guess we also saw some of the neighborhoods where your workers live."
"I had Shane oversee some of their construction, and for once he didn't. I mean to say, he did a pretty good job."
"Thanks, Pop,"
said Shane, seemingly oblivious to the underlying meaning in his father's praise. He seemed to have eyes only for Caroline, who would not meet his gaze. Decker said,
"Did either of you know Irene Kramer?"
Stuart shook his head.
"Shane?"
He finally managed to draw his gaze from Caroline and said, "Nope, didn't know her."
"Why is the FBI here?" asked Stuart. "I mean, don't you people have anything better to do than investigate local murders? We have police to do that. Shouldn't you be going after terrorists and the like?"
"We cover a lot of ground," said Decker, "and we go where we're told to go. So, nothing else you can tell us about Kramer?"
Caroline Dawson said,
"She lived in an apartment building. It wasn't one of the nicer ones, but it was affordable. But it's also one of the few that your father doesn't own, or at least we were told that,"
Jameson pointed out.
"So how did you know that she lived there?" "I went there to drop off an offer to purchase the building this morning. Ida Sims, the manager, told me that she'd live there."
"So you're looking to buy that building, huh?" said Stuart. "Why's that? Your daddy's been building like crazy the last 2 years.
"Well, he can't build fast enough to support all the people moving in to work at your fracking operations,"
retorted Dawson.
"So we want to buy that building, rehab it, and then rent it out. It needs a lot of work."
"And you'll charge a nice premium for it when all is said and done," commented Stuart.
"That's sort of the point,"
Dawson said.
"But it's also not cheap to rehab, and it's really hard to find workers. Everyone wants to frack. It pays a lot."
"That's not my problem," said Stuart.
"We built those other tract neighborhoods for your workers as fast as we could."
Stuart laughed, pulled a short cigarillo from his pocket and stuck it in his mouth, unlit.
"Your old man went cheap on the materials like he always does. I've had complaints from my workers. That's why I'm starting to build my own."
Dawson looked at him sternly.
"If they have complaints, they should take them up with us, not you. We have an entire department that focuses solely on matters like that."
Stuart rolled his eyes.
"Sure, sure. I bet that's a priority for you all."
Dawson apparently had had enough. She looked at Decker and Jameson.
"Well, I hope you find who you're looking for, if you'll excuse me."
As she turned to leave, Shane called out,
"Bye, Caroline. Maybe I'll see you around."
She didn't look back, but merely waved. Decker noted that Stuart McClellan eyed her every step of the way. After she was gone, Stuart said,
"That girl has some issues. anger issues.
She seemed perfectly reasonable to me,
said Jameson. Shane said,
She works hard, Dad. You have to admit that.
I do admit that, and I wish you worked just as hard.
Well, work's not everything in life.
Shane turned and gazed in the direction where Caroline had gone. Stuart followed this and then stuck a finger in his son's broad chest.
You work for your family. You work for me. Your loyalties lie there, son. No room for anything else. And if you make work everything in your life for a long enough time, then you'll find you have the means to do what you want when your work is done.
He glanced at Decker.
Do you not agree? I think everybody's different, so one-size advice doesn't fit all. Well, with that perspective, it's a wonder we ever liberated ourselves from the British or won World War II. I wish you luck with your investigation, and with that attitude, I think you're going to need all the luck you can get.
He turned and strode off. Shane looked at them sheepishly.
He gets on his soapbox a lot.
I'm sure,
said Jameson.
Nice meeting you,
said Shane, and then he hurried after his father. Jameson looked at Decker.
I couldn't stand being around his father for 5 seconds.
When Decker didn't answer, she looked at him. He was staring pensively at the ceiling.
What are the McClellans doing here?
He said.
Why is that our concern?
Because you never know how things will pan out, Alex. That's why.
Chapter 15.
That is one of the most unusual buildings I think I've ever seen, especially in a place like this,
said Jameson, as she, Decker, and Kelly drew closer to the chopped-off pyramid representing the centerpiece of the Douglas S. George Defense Complex. They could see now that it was surrounded by other far more ordinary-looking buildings. Kelly said,
I remember as a kid seeing it and imagining all sorts of things going on inside there. We pretended that it was a castle with a damsel in distress inside that we were going to rescue. We would charge it on our bicycles and minibikes.
Jameson glanced at him with an amused look.
And did you ever rescue her?
Kelly grinned sheepishly.
Only in our dreams. The fact was, you couldn't get near this place. As kids, we did come close sometimes. Even once ran into a soldier carrying a big-ass gun. I think we all wet our pants when he suddenly appeared out of nowhere. But he was nice. Didn't give us a hard time. We were just dumb boys messing around. He gave us some gum and a warning and sent us on our way.
You said there were some incidents here before,
noted Decker.
Just stupid stuff. Couple of drunken fights.
Anything else?
Decker persisted.
Not really.
Okay,
said Decker, looking thoughtful. They were cleared through a security post manned by a quartet of very serious-looking men wearing level 2 body armor and holding combat weapons. They were dressed all in black, with security stenciled on the backs of their vests.
Vector,
said Decker, reading this name off the label on one of the guard's sleeves. Kelly said,
Vector is the contractor that runs this place. They're the subsidiary of some big player in the arena. At least that's what I heard.
They drove to a one-story brick building. It was within walking distance of the pyramid. Decker eyed the line of ambulances parked in a row next to the pyramid. They were escorted inside by a uniformed guard and led down a short corridor to a large office. The guard left, and Kelly introduced them to Colonel Mark Sumter. He was medium height, about 50, trim with a bald head and intense blue eyes. He was dressed in an ABU, or Airman Battle Uniform, that carried a camouflage design. He invited them to sit down across from his desk in 3 straight-back chairs.
Good to see you, Joe.
He looked at Decker and Jameson.
So you're the FBI. How can I help?
Decker said,
There's been a murder. A young woman named Irene Kramer.
Yes, I heard about that.
She taught school at the Brothers Colony, added Kelly.
Did she?
Sumter looked interested.
Do you suspect someone from there might have been involved? They're very religious folks, from what I understand. Pacifists, in fact.
Decker shrugged.
We're just gathering facts, conducting interviews, nailing down timelines.
Jameson interjected.
I guess it's unusual to be sharing property lines with a religious organization.
Sumter bristled a bit.
The DOD, with all its money, somehow found it imperative to sell off most of the land surrounding this installation. Now, I have no problem with the brothers. I'm just not used to being on base and seeing a tractor plowing a field in the distance, or oil rigs pumping up crude from the earth. I'm one who likes more buffer, particularly with what we do here.
And what is that? Asked Decker. Kelly just gave us a thumbnail sketch.
Sumter instantly adopted a more guarded look.
Much of what we do is classified.
Just the non-classified parts, then, said Decker. Kelly here said you watch the sky for nukes.
In part. Have you ever heard of parks?
As in, like, parks people visit?
Said Jameson.
Sumter smiled. No, it's an acronym, just like everything else in the military. It stands for Perimeter Acquisition Radar Attack Characterization System.
Long name.
And it's justified. Along with watching for nuclear weapons, we also track Earth-orbiting objects.
Why's that?
Asked Decker.
We're sort of like air traffic control for outer space. We analyze and track about 20,000 objects per day, from giant satellites to small space debris. We can spot something the size of a soccer ball at a distance of 2,000 miles.
Expensive pair of binoculars,
commented Decker, drawing a sharp and somewhat unfriendly glance from Sumter. Jameson said in a more casual tone,
I understand you have a bar and even a bowling alley on site?
Sumter smiled. Yes, drinking and bowling, not the best of combinations, but still, it allows people to wind down.
How long has Vector been running this place? Asked Decker.
The United States Air Force runs this place, said Sumter firmly. But Vector's involvement is fairly recent. I can't give you the exact date because that's classified.
So getting back to Irene Kramer, has she ever been here? Asked Decker.
No, and she wouldn't have the clearance to get on the installation.
Would she know any of the people who worked here?
I don't see why.
Well, she worked right next door,
said Jameson.
Yes, but no one from the brothers can just stroll over here.
Kramer had a second occupation, said Decker.
What was that?
An old-fashioned way of terming it would be a lady of the night.
She was a hooker? Said Sumter, sitting upright.
Decker just stared at him.
Now Sumter looked more guarded. And you think one of the men here?
I just want to acquire the facts. It's sort of like your radar here, always sucking up information.
Sumter eyed Decker in a new light.
I can make inquiries.
Decker said,
Actually, we would prefer to do that. I doubt that anyone here will volunteer that they paid a hooker. Wouldn't that land them in trouble?
It could, but we're experienced with ferreting out the truth.
Kelly said,
Why don't you make a first sweep? Narrow it down, and then we can interview those folks. I'll have to think about that.
This is a murder investigation, said Decker. A young woman was badly butchered.
And this is a U.S. military installation, retorted Sumter, and we do things a certain way. Now, if that's all, I can get on with my duties, and you all can do the same.
As they were leaving, Decker turned back.
You have many accidents here?
No. It's not really a dangerous place to be stationed. Beats the hell out of Iraq or Afghanistan, he added with a forced grin.
That's great. Keep up the good work.
As they were walking to their truck, Jameson said,
Why did you ask him that?
Because I wanted to know the answer, Decker said bluntly. And that answer has led to another question.
What's that? Asked Kelly.
Decker pointed to the ambulances.
If this is such a safe place, what the hell are all those for?
Chapter 16. When Decker got back to his hotel room, he ended up taking Jameson's advice and calling his sister, but probably not for the reason his partner had intended. Renee exclaimed,
Okay, I'm going to stroke out. Amos Decker calls his big sister. Stop the presses.
Growing up, I never really realized how funny you were, Renee.
Disappointed how our last conversation went? Want to make amends?
Right now, I just want Stan's cell phone number.
You didn't get it from him when you saw him?
It didn't seem appropriate under the circumstances.
She gave him the number, and he put it in his contacts.
Thanks. Stan said Diane's husband lost his job.
That was a year ago. Tim's back on his feet and Diane has a good job. They're doing okay. And I guess it's a good thing they don't have any kids they have to support. Now, don't call me for another year.
What? Why?
I need time to recover from the shock of talking to you twice in such a short time.
He next called his brother-in-law. Baker was at work but got off at 5:30. Decker arranged to meet up with him at the OK Corral Saloon at 7:30. He had some time to kill and decided to put it to good use. He pulled out a copy of the pathology report from the post-mortem that Walt Southern had performed on Irene Kramer's remains. He went over it, page by page, line by line. When he got to one sentence, buried in the middle of a long paragraph near the end of the report, he sat up.
Son of a bitch.
He headed out. The rain had stopped falling, but the humidity level was off the charts. He turned left and reached the funeral home a few minutes later. A young man outfitted all in black except for his dazzling white shirt rose from behind a small desk and greeted him. Decker asked for Walt Southern, who wasn't there, but his wife Liz was. She came out a minute later. Liz Southern was not dressed in black, but rather in lavender. She stood out like a pink flamingo in a desert, and it occurred to Decker even more forcefully how strikingly attractive the woman was. He wondered how happy she was working with dead people. But then again, someone had to do it.
What can I do for you, Agent Decker?
I was hoping to talk to your husband.
He's out of town. Be back tomorrow. Is there anything I can help you with?
In answer, Decker held up the autopsy report.
Had some questions about this.
She looked at him in surprise.
Questions about the report Walt did?
It's not unusual for detectives to have follow-up questions about a post-mortem report.
Well, is it something I can help you with? I've picked up a lot just being around Walt and also with the business we're in.
He flipped to a page of the report and pointed at one long section.
Buried in the middle of this, it says that her intestines and stomach were sliced open.
She stiffened.
But isn't it standard procedure to take out the stomach and slice it open to analyze its contents?
Yes, it is, only these cuts were not done by your husband, which is why I need to see her remains, now.
She led him into a room where the thermostat was set very low. It felt great after all the heat outside.
Out of the fryer and into the fridge.
Set against one wall were columns of small doors behind which corpses were kept in refrigerated climates. Southern opened one of the drawers and slid the gurney out.
There she is,
she said. Decker nodded and glanced at her when the woman made no sign of leaving.
Thanks. I'll let you know when I'm done.
She seemed unsure about this, but withdrew from the room. Decker turned to the body when something suddenly occurred to him.
The room's not electric blue.
It wasn't that he missed experiencing this phenomenon, but Decker's brain had begun to change recently. His memory had hiccups, and he had momentarily forgotten some things he thought he never would, and he didn't enjoy change like that. Decker lifted the sheet off the corpse and looked down at Kramer. The first time he had viewed her body, he had known nothing of the woman's past. Now he knew that she was a teacher and possibly a prostitute slash escort, although the jury was still out on that. And he also knew that her past beyond her time here was a mystery. But what he had always known was that someone had murdered her. Decker turned to the pages in the report that contained photos of the deceased's remains. There were pictures of every organ, but Decker focused on the images of the small and large intestines and the stomach. The slices referenced in the report had not been photographed, which was why Decker was here. He was about to do something he had never done before, something he had never even thought of doing before. But under the circumstances, he could see no way around it. After finding them in a locker, Decker put on gloves, donned a long apron, and settled a surgical mask over his mouth and nose, and a pair of goggles over his eyes. He grabbed short-handled forceps off a tray and pulled out the Y-incision sutures, often called the baseball stitch because of its resemblance to that threading. Inside the revealed cavity, the woman's organs had been placed in bags to prevent leakage. He took out the stomach and looked at it from every angle he could. It had been sliced open on the bottom, revealing the inside of the organ, like a slit balloon. Southern had apparently used this opening to examine the stomach's contents because Decker could see no other incision. Whoever had made this cut had saved him the trouble. He used an overhead light to peer into the chest cavity once more and opened the bag containing the intestines. They lay coiled inside like a snake sleeping. He saw where sections of them had also been sliced open in multiple locations. He hit these spots as best he could with the light. The slits were large enough to get a hand into them. Decker knew that for sure, because he did so himself. The cuts were jagged and seemed hurried, as though the killer had either been rushed while doing it, or had he gotten frustrated? Decker took pictures of everything with his smartphone. He bagged the organs, closed the cavity, redid the sutures, covered the body once more, and slid it back into the drawer. Then he disposed of the gloves, apron, and mask in a metal container marked medical waste. He put the used goggles on a metal table. He then washed up in the sink. He let the warm water and soap flood his face, and then stared at himself in the mirror attached to the wall above the sink. "I can't fucking believe I just did that." He closed his eyes. He felt like he might be sick, but he managed to keep what was in his stomach right where it was. Too bad Irene Kramer hadn't been able to do the same. He left without speaking to Liz Southern. He had nothing to say to the woman, and he wanted to get outside. His legs felt wobbly, and he was again feeling nauseous. The heat hit him as he opened the exterior door, and surprisingly, his sick feeling began to dissipate. His body was now probably focused on dealing with the hot environment. He slowly and gingerly walked back to the hotel. Decker went up to his room, pulled out his phone, and looked at the pictures he'd taken. They were far sharper with a higher res than the grainy ones provided by Walt Southern. Decker might have just made a significant stride in the investigation, but the discovery had also led to a great many more questions. The stomach and intestines shared an attribute that none of the other organs in the body did. If you swallowed something, the object would eventually travel to those two destinations. Irene Kramer had been carrying something in her belly or intestines, and whoever had killed her had taken it from the woman. Chapter 17.
Oh my God, you did what?
Jameson was sitting in the driver's seat of their rental SUV, staring at Decker like he had just told her that he'd been the one who'd murdered Irene Kramer.
"Didn't you hear me the first time?" he said, looking slightly embarrassed. "The killer was obviously attempting to get something back that Kramer had ingested."
"Look, despite what you found, that theory seems a little far-fetched."
"Drug mules do that all the time. They either stuff plastic bags of drugs up their anuses, or else they swallow them."
"And very often the bags burst and the person dies when all those drugs enter their body."
She glanced sharply at him.
"Is that what you think, that she was a drug runner?"
"That would be the easy answer, but I'm not sure it would be the right one," he replied. "And there's something else."
"What?"
"Why didn't Walt Southern highlight this fact for us? It was literally buried in his report, and there were no pictures of the cuts to those organs. And when I asked him if there was anything out of the ordinary, he replied in the negative."
"You think he didn't believe it was important?"
"Any pathologist worth his or her salt knows about contraband being carried in the body."
"I guess that is odd. So what do you think?"
"Did he intentionally not highlight it or take pictures, thinking we would just take his word and not look too closely at the pathology report?"
"But why would he do that? Wait, do you think he killed her? That would explain the way she was cut up. He would have just performed two autopsies on her."
"Southern cutting her up like that would be really the only way we would suspect someone like him. So why would he do it that way, unless he wants to be caught?"
"No, I don't see that happening either,"
commented Jameson.
"So let's go back to the question of what she might have been carrying inside her."
"I guess we could harken back to the days of the Cold War. She could be a spy and swallowed a microfiche dot loaded with government secrets."
When Decker didn't respond to this, she added,
"I'm just kidding. She's too young to have been part of the Cold War."
"But why wouldn't that be plausible? We have a pretty sensitive government facility right in the neighborhood."
Jameson said slowly,
"Since we don't know her past, it could be she was a spy."
"And maybe the reason she came here was to spy on the Douglas S. George Defense Complex.
but she's been here a year, he added, looking puzzled.
Meaning what took her so long?
Said Jameson. Decker nodded.
How was doing what you did?
She asked.
I never want to do it again.
So what now?
Bogart hasn't gotten back to me. If we can't get at her past from the Bureau's side, we need to try from another angle. She was here a year. Someone might have seen or heard something suspicious about the lady.
So we talked to people, but we already did that.
I think some of the people we've talked to have been less than forthcoming. And Colonel Sumter was stonewalling us the whole way.
But how do we get him to talk? He has the DOD behind him. He has to follow orders.
I'm not sure. So for now, we keep pushing ahead on other paths. We met one local titan with Stuart McClellan. Maybe we should meet the other.
Caroline's dad, I guess he might know something useful.
Well, for one thing, he was the one to hire Hal Parker to get the wolf that had killed his cattle. So the body was presumably found on his property.
Do you think he knew Irene Kramer?
That's one of the first things I'm going to ask him.
They got Kelly to join them, and he gave directions to Hugh Dawson's estate. Kelly eyed Decker, who sat in the front seat next to Jameson.
So why the interest in Dawson? You never said.
We're just trying to get the lay of the land at this point.
Okay, that really tells me nothing.
Jameson added,
We're not trying to play coy, Joe. We're looking around for some traction on this case. We've talked to the military and the brothers and people who knew Kramer. We talked to Caroline Dawson and we ran into the McClellans. So we're rounding it out with Hugh Dawson.
When did you see the McClellans?
At the restaurant at our hotel,
replied Jameson.
Both of them?
He sounded so puzzled that Decker turned to look at him.
Yeah, why? Is that unusual?
Kelly shrugged.
Stuart, as a rule, doesn't frequent places owned by Hugh Dawson.
And the son?
Asked Jameson.
Shane McClellan looked to me like he was head over heels for Caroline.
Shane's a nice guy. Not what you would call an intellectual, but he's got a good heart.
He added in a more subdued tone.
And you're right. He's got it bad for Caroline. Has since we were kids.
But that would be a problem, considering the fathers are business rivals, noted Decker.
Sounds like Romeo and Juliet,
interjected Jameson.
Or the Hatfields and McCoys, replied Decker.
I think you might be closer to the mark with that one, said Kelly. But though they don't get along, and they are sort of in a pissing contest like Ida Sims said, they're not exactly true rivals either. Hugh's businesses service Stuart's workers. That actually helps both of them.
And what about Shane's mother?
Asked Jameson.
Catherine McClellan died a while back. Cancer. She and Shane were really close. A lot closer than he and his old man. After that, it was just Shane and his father. Not the best of situations. Catherine acted as a buffer between the two. After she was gone, well, it wasn't pretty.
Sounds complicated,
said Jameson. Kelly nodded.
It is.
I take it you and Shane are friends. You're close to the same age.
We all went to high school together. Caroline, too. Yeah, we were all good friends. Pretty much inseparable.
Getting back to the case, Hal Parker was hired by Hugh Dawson, said Decker, to hunt down a wolf?
Yep.
Wolves are a problem around here.
They certainly can be. Them and wild dogs, coyotes, mountain lions, they can devastate a herd.
What else can you tell us about Hugh Dawson? Asked Decker. You said he was big and gregarious, but could take your head off if need be.
That's pretty much all you need to know about the man. I'll leave it to you to form your own impression when you meet him.
And you said his wife died in an accident?
Said Jameson.
Kelly nodded. It was really tragic. The worst sort of accident, because it was like a perfect storm of connected events. Maddie Dawson was caught in her car in a blizzard and died from carbon monoxide poisoning.